I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The fighting in Syria has claimed more than 100,000 civilian lives. Millions are displaced within their country, and millions more have fled to neighboring countries. While some are living in refugee camps, there are reports of Syrian children begging on the streets of Beirut, Lebanon. Meanwhile, in Syria, rebel groups are fighting each other, and what began as public protests for more freedoms has devolved into a sectarian civil war. Today on Radio Times, we discuss the political and humanitarian crisis in Syria. We have two guests. Reese Ehrlich is special correspondent for Global Post and lead reporter for their series In the Land of Cain and Abel. He has traveled to Syria six times since the uprisings began. And Reese Ehrlich, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, good morning to you, Mike.
Good morning to you as well. Also with us is Sarah Leah Woodson, Director of the Middle East and North Africa Divisions of Human Rights Watch. And Sarah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I know you've been monitoring the refugee crisis, and I want to break it down into some of its parts. Help us understand what's happening inside of Syria. Reading is about as many as 4 million people displaced within their own country. Where do they go?
If you're asking me, sorry, this
I
is
am.
Sarah Leah Woodson. The situation is as reported. Where they go is to camps within the country that have been set up, other villages in makeshift homes, makeshift shelters within the country. Many are amassed closer to the border of the area where they feel safest, depending on their community affiliation. So some flee to rebel-held areas, others flee to government-held areas seeking security and shelter, as well, of course, as the 1.6 million, almost 2 million refugees outside the country now.
And I do want to talk about them as well. Reese, let me get you into the conversation as someone who has been reporting from Syria. You see refugees within that country?
Well, it's not always easy, unless they're in the camps, as Sarah described. I was in Damascus, and you see people crowded into apartments with relatives and friends. They're displaced within their own community. So you do have a sense of that, but the government is trying to deal as best as it can with the huge displacement, and the people are fleeing based on their political inclinations. Many have gone to rebel areas where they feel safer, and others have fled to Damascus.
Let me go back to you, Sarah. You mentioned something like 2 million people have left Syria and are living in neighboring countries.
The number 1, 2, 3 countries are Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. And, particularly for Jordan and Lebanon, which have small populations, the sheer scale and number of Syrian refugees is overwhelming. There are now more Syrian school children inside Lebanon than there are Lebanese school children.
Wow.
It's an unbelievable drain on the resources of relatively impoverished countries. Turkey has a little more capacity to deal with the influx of the refugees. But in Lebanon, for example, most of the refugees are not in refugee camps. They're living within society, and that in itself creates tensions as they compete for scarce jobs and overrun social services. And the international community has failed. Even the so-called friends of Syria and those who are supporting the opposition and the uprising in Syria have not paid up their full contributions to the UN refugee agency to help pay for the needs of these refugees. And so, again, it is these governments that are shouldering a lot of the burden and cost of these refugees.
And I'm assuming if we're talking about Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, that they also took in refugees from the Iraq war. So in many ways, this is another wave of refugees that they have to deal with.
It is, and it is, and then these countries have seen waves and waves of refugees. Of course, before that, they've seen waves and waves of Palestinian refugees. And Lebanon and Jordan in particular have shouldered the brunt of Iraqi refugees, which is overwhelming given their population sizes. Many Iraqi refugees returned from Syria, from Jordan in particular, but also from Lebanon back to Iraq. And of course now you have even Iraq taking in Syrian refugees. So it has sadly been decades of refugee and displacement due to conflict in the region.
And Reese, how much is this destabilizing this very volatile region of the world?
Oh, it's tremendously destabilizing. I reported on the refugees both in Turkey and in Iraqi Kurdistan and in Lebanon. And as your listeners know, in Lebanon, the war is spilling over. There's been suicide bombings and bombings of both pro-Hezbollah and anti-Hezbollah, pro-Syrian and anti-Syrian forces in Lebanon. And the refugees are partially caught up in that maelstrom. Mm. The refugees, I interviewed Sunni refugees who are living in the poorest parts of Tripoli that used to be inhabited by the poorest Lebanese. And then I also interviewed Christian refugees who are a bit better off economically, but they're crowded into multiple families into one apartment and trying to survive as best they can.
Reese, we're going to call you back and try to get you on a better phone line. So just
sure.
If you don't mind just hanging up, we'll call you back and cross our fingers and hope that we can get you on a better phone line, I should say. Sarah Leah Whitson staying with us as we talk about the humanitarian political crisis in Syria. And again, she's director of the Middle East and North Africa divisions of Human Rights Watch. Sarah, I was reading from some of your reporting and some of other people's reporting about the refugee crisis is the number of children that have been affected by all the fighting, as many as a million children. Help us understand what's happening to them.
Well, women and children are typically the first to flee and the first to be given access to flee to refugee camps, and so that explains, of course, a large size of them. And in addition to the fact that the majority of Syria's population are children under the age of 18, mm. Many of them have been hosted in schools and in makeshift schools. There is a lot of charity coming in to Lebanon and Jordan in particular to help school refugees with, you know, private donor support, a lot of private donor support. That being said, there are many, many, many Syrian school children who are not in school, who are left out of school, and who are instead begging. The streets of Beirut are littered with Syrian child beggars who are, you know, the only sort of line between them and their family starvation is the amount they're able to gather by begging on the streets of Beirut. And it's a completely tragic situation because it will mean a lost year of school, lost years of school, and tremendous damage on the children who are traumatized already, having lost their homes, but now also losing their education.
There are reports, and including from Human Rights Watch and others, about Christians in this region of the world, and we're talking about Syria here, who have been targeted. Can you help us understand what kinds of violations against Christians living in Syria?
Well, there are a host of violations against minority groups or various ethnic and religious groups in Syria. So you have the Alawi Shia government devolving this situation into a war against the majority Sunni Muslim population. And because the Alawi government is associated or supported by, to some extent, not entirely, right, by Christians and the wealthier Sunni community, there's a backlash against them as well. In addition, some of the extremist Islamist fighting groups that have entered and taken over parts of Syria are targeting Christians, kidnapping them, in many cases desecrating and burning churches, but as well as other, there have been attacks against Shia shrines as well. So I wouldn't say that Christians are in particular being targeted, but there is a sectarian dimension to the conflict in Syria that is harming various ethnic groups in the country.
So we're talking about serious human rights, civil rights violations.
Absolutely, and the worst of it, of course, is the massive indiscriminate bombardment of civilian areas in Syria by the government, by the government forces. So it's important to emphasize the abuses of rebels, particularly, obviously, as well against minority groups such as Christians, Armenian Christians, and so forth. But at the same time, it's important to not lose sight of the fact that the vast majority of the killings in the country and the unlawful killings in the country are by the hands of the Syrian government.
Is there any way to be able to be confident about the scale of abuse?
Well, we have the numbers. I think the latest numbers that we considered reliable estimates the number of dead at 135,000, I think is the last number we've seen. We ourselves document killings from indiscriminate bombardment in various sites where we actually examine the particular attack and the particular deaths. There was a count, obviously, of the numbers killed by chemical strikes, and there are a number of groups inside and outside of Syria who are keeping casualty tolls. And so there are, in fact, pretty reliable, solid figures on the number of casualties from this conflict.
Reese, let me get you back in on the conversation, hoping we have a better phone line here.
Sure.
That's much better, thank you. Talking with Sarah about the human rights abuses in Syria, and since you've been reporting from there, I'd like to get your perspective on this important issue.
Yeah, I interviewed some civil society activists that I had met 2 years ago who had been leaders of the nonviolent protests in the initial uprising. And they've been driven deeply underground. It's almost impossible to function at doing peaceable opposition in Damascus. One of them has joined the Free Syrian Army and become a devout Muslim. Another continues to do humanitarian work, trying to get food and medical supplies into some of the besieged cities. But the circumstances have become extremely difficult for people who oppose Assad and also oppose the extremist rebels. A third one of the civil society activists that I know had been arrested and horribly tortured and has now basically disappeared in the jail system of Syria. The human rights situation is quite serious.
Sarah, we're talking about really a sectarian civil war in Syria, are we not?
Well,
I
would say that is sadly now a dominant dimension of this uprising. It started as an uprising for rights and freedom, inspired by this uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt, and Yemen. It has devolved and deliberately been transformed into Alawi / Shia versus Sunni conflict, particularly with the proliferation of extremist Islamist groups, fighting groups in Syria, many of whom come from outside the country, who had nothing to do with the initial uprising for rights and freedom. And so it has morphed into a civil war with overwhelmingly sectarian elements to it. And I have to emphasize that this is fueled by those who are arming and supporting this war, namely Saudi Arabia and Iran, for whom this is all about Saudi Arabia and Iran much more than it is about the Syrian people.
Well, on that note, we do have to say goodbye to you. We're going to take a very short break and continue our conversation with Reese Ehrlich. Sarah Leah Whitson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's director of the Middle East and North Africa divisions of Human Rights Watch. And again, Reese Ehrlich staying with us for the rest of the hour, special correspondent for Global Post. He's been their lead reporter for their series titled In the Land of Cain and Abel. He has traveled to Syria about 6 times since the uprising began almost 3 years ago, talking with government officials, rebels, civilians in Syria, and some of the neighboring countries as well. 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Any questions or comments? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Maryland Institute College of Art. MICA's Master's of Professional Studies offers business education with creativity. Degrees include information visualization and the business of art and design. Information at mica.edu/HYY.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you 2 tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, can paralyzing injuries in hockey be prevented by an orange warning line in front of the boards?
You're going to get caught with your head down, yet you don't know when you're going out of bounds or going to hit the boards until you actually hit the board.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO, smart ideas for your business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at PICO.com/smart ideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Reese Ehrlich about the political and humanitarian crisis in Syria. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Reese, I know you have reported been to Syria 6 times since the beginning of the uprising, and I'm just curious about what Damascus was like in, what, March of 2011 and what you have observed more recently.
Yeah, let me just clarify that I've been to Syria a total of 6 times, but twice since the uprising.
Okay, fair enough.
On my most recent trip, which is just in November, Damascus is really a city at war. You enter the city and you hear artillery fire and machine gun fire all afternoon, all day, all night. It's the Syrian army bombarding the southern suburbs or the towns just on the southern extremities of Damascus. Every day, seemingly, or every few days, there's a rocket or mortar fire from the rebels that come in and hit various parts of Damascus. There are attacks on military bases nearby. So the city is, you really are a city under siege and at war. There's checkpoints. From the hotel where I normally stay to the old city, it was a 15-minute cab ride. It's now 45 minutes because you have to go through 2 or 3 checkpoints just to get there. So people are really feeling under siege. Even the Assad supporters, and there are some, are very much feeling under siege.
How is there a simple answer to the question about how, over what, almost 3 years now, how what began as this call for democracy, a call for greater freedoms, has become this sectarian civil war? Is there a simple answer to what happened?
Well, I don't know if it's simple, but what happened was the Assad government took a very hard line. There were no splits, significant splits in the Syrian military as there were in Tunisia and Egypt. So they were able to keep up the repression. And out of self-defense, people turned to armed struggle as a way to fight the regime. And when you turn to arms, some of the people from Iraq and Saudi Arabia and others who had military training or arms were able to gain the upper hand in some parts of the country, and that's these Islamic extremist groups that we've heard so much about. So it's a situation that we've seen in Iraq. We may be seeing it in South Sudan. There's a very strong sectarian character to it, but this is not ancient animosities of Alawi, Shia, and Sunni fighting it out. This is opportunist leaders on both sides using religion to promote themselves into power.
And taking advantage of what? The instability, the political power vacuums within this country of Syria?
Yeah, exactly. And so if the government is not functioning, some of these extremist rebel groups, they come in. In fact, in some cases, they take it over from other rebel groups, and then impose their harsh version of Sharia law. And in the Assad-controlled areas, there's rampant corruption and kidnapping, for example, within the pro-Assad areas, kidnapping of Christians and others, because there's no law. Law and order has broken down.
I mean, is there any way to determine who is winning this civil war in Syria?
Well, both sides claim that they're winning, and I think a fair assessment, at least at this time, is it's a stalemate. The Assad government was making some advances among the southern towns outside of Damascus. They claimed some victories in Homs and in Aleppo. But as the fighting continues, it's obvious that some of those claims were exaggerated. So I'd say it's a stalemate.
As we know, President Obama drew a line in the sand about chemical weapons, and then when it was found that Assad had chemical weapons, he did not send in the military as he said he would do. Nonetheless, it looks like these chemical weapons have at least been identified and are ready for, I guess, shipment and destruction. How do you understand U.S. policy as it relates to Syria?
Well, there's a common misunderstanding in the U.S. that Obama has no strategy or that he was fumbling around or whatever. He had a strategy. It just didn't work. From the very beginning, from, let's say, after the first few months of the uprising, the Obama administration was trying a tried-and-true
strategy of find a pro-U.S. strongman, arm and train rebels to support him, put him in power, and call him an emerging Democrat and the country an emerging democracy. The U.S. did that in Iraq and
right.
Afghanistan, tried to do it in Libya. But the guy that was picked and the forces that were picked don't have much popular support inside Syria, and that's why the policy failed. I think it's a very good thing that the Syrian government is getting rid of its chemical weapons. It, by all indications, there seems to be an honest effort on both sides. That's very positive, but that is only one small component for resolving the issue.
With the advantage of hindsight, and obviously you're a critic of the Obama administration's policy in Syria, what would have been a better policy, do you think?
Well, I think what has made the situation much worse is the outside interference by various countries, including the U.S., including Saudi Arabia, including Russia and Iran. And I think to the extent that the U.S. had ability to pressure its allies, I think the Saudis have been funding some of these very extremist Islamist groups, and the U.S., while unhappy with that, has not actually done much to stop it because of its concerns with other parts of relations with Saudi Arabia. So I think the U.S. could have really not interfered itself and put a lot of pressure on others not to interfere either. I know it's not something that's commonly discussed in Washington because it's assumed that if the U.S. isn't there, it's a vacuum and somebody else will fill it. But the U.S. does not have to get involved in every war and every crisis in the world.
Put pressure, what, on Saudi Arabia not to arm the rebels that they support in Syria?
Well, no, not to arm anybody.
Or not to arm anybody.
I know in Washington I'm considered a little crazy for advocating things like that, but I think the people of Syria can resolve these issues themselves, given enough time.
Resolve it with Assad himself?
Well, I think I think ultimately Assad is going to be out. I think there is going to be a political settlement ultimately. Perhaps some elements of the Assad regime would stay in power together with some of the centrist and right conservative rebel groups, and hopefully the civil society activists. Some combination of those folks will be in power. I don't think Assad is going to last. Although, of course, he thinks he will.
Well, and I do want to pick up on all of that. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on our conversation. We are talking about Syria, the fact that the fighting looks like it has turned into a civil war with sectarian overtones, almost 3 years since the demonstrations have led to some of this fighting. Reese Ehrlich, special correspondent for Global Post, their lead reporter for their series titled In the Land of Cain and Abel. He's been to Syria a couple of times. He's interviewed government officials, rebels, civilians as well. In fact, is working on a book to be published next year about Syria. We are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me see what Jim from Haverford has to say. And Jim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there.
Hi there.
Quick question following up on the chemical weapons issue.
Yep.
Why did it seem that the whole world was staring this down with chemical weapons, and like you said, Obama drew a line in the sand, and now we recognize that, of course, over 100,000 people are dead. It seems from the media and from the White House there's nothing going on now. Is there any kind of long-term strategy here? Do we have any thoughts about how to get involved to stop this?
Well, actually, there has been some reporting. Obviously, it depends on who and what you read or listen to or watch. But let me get Reese Ehrlich to respond to this.
The Obama administration is continuing with a version of that strategy I described earlier. There are CIA agents in Jordan working out of the refugee camps there where the Syrians are living and training groups of 20, 30, 40 Syrians to become guerrilla fighters and arming them, and in hopes that that will be a counterforce both to Assad and to the extremist rebels. But Saudi Arabia and Qatar are continuing to arm other rebel groups. So there is active intervention by the United States. That what is not happening is the bombing of Syria that Obama had promised in August and was not able to do because of popular opinion.
And my understanding from reading the New York Times and others is something like 1,300 tons of chemical weapons have been collected. They're ready to be destroyed and apparently waiting for a U.S. ship to basically take care of that.
Yeah, and they're having some difficulties transporting the chemical weapons from their various military bases to Latakia, which is the port city where the ship will be near where the ship will be docked. So, from all indications from the UN and from others, the Syrian government is making an honest effort to get rid of the chemical weapons, but it's a country in war, and the road, for example, from Damascus to Latakia is not open. And so how do you transport those chemical components?
Mm-hmm. Jim, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Reese, President Obama was criticized for essentially drawing a line in the sand, and then when these chemical weapons were identified, not following through on some kind of military strike. Do you think that was a mistake on the administration's part?
Well, this is where I'm researching for my book, and I've dug up some new information, and Seymour Hersh, the famed investigative journalist, also wrote about this. The common understanding is that the government used chemical weapons back in April of last year. The Obama administration refused to respond, and that encouraged them then to use the weapons later. There's very strong evidence that some of the rebel groups, particularly al-Nusra, had access to chemical weapons and had brought them into Syria. And those early examples of the use of weapons were against Syrian soldiers. So it really doesn't make any sense why would the Assad government use chemical weapons against its own people. Mm. And they were rather crude usages of it, not using missiles or mortars or anything like that, but rather just low-level exposure or local exposure. So there's certainly circumstantial evidence that al-Nusra was using chemical weapons in an effort to get the U.S. involved sway public opinion against the Assad government. Now, the famous incident in August, which was hundreds of people used, the Assad government claims that was also rebel use of chemical weapons. That's a harder case to make. I interviewed a lot of people in Damascus with the pro-government view, and they did not present a convincing argument. But there's enough details missing, and Cy Hirsch's articles raises enough questions to say that it's not all that clear who used it, even in that incident. With that in perspective, then you go back to April. If you're the president, and it turns out that the rebels that you support may have used the chemical weapons, you're not going to go to war behind it. It wasn't a question of lack of will. It was a question of who really was responsible for the use of those weapons.
Well, it seems that there are two things. One is these allegations of the involvement of al-Nusra. Now, al-Nusra is a rebel group that the U.S. supports?
No, it's one of the extremist groups.
That's what I thought.
That's affiliated with al-Qaeda.
Right.
And some of their members were arrested in Turkey with sarin gas, an incident that was widely reported at the time and then hushed up.
So could it be possible that both things are true, which is that some of these Syrian groups had access to chemical weapons and the Syrian government has or had chemical weapons?
Yes, it's for sure the Syrian government had the chemical weapons. And yes, it's perfectly possible that there were, in different incidents, both sides used the chemical weapons.
But I guess it'd be fair to say that Syria is just, awash with weapons now?
Certainly not awash with chemical weapons,
no.
But certainly awash with weapons in general. Yeah, it's very easy to get AK-47s and our rocket-propelled grenades and other small arms machine guns. They're smuggled in easily from Turkey and from Jordan. Yeah, and of course the Russians are supplying and the Iranians are supplying arms to the Syrian government. So, yeah, arms are cheap these days.
Mm. Let me get, looks like Peter from Lumberton to join us on Radio Times. And Peter, go ahead. You are on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up. You had already asked the guest a question, and I don't think I understood what his response was. Your question was, if the Obama policy was not effective, what does he think would have been a more effective strategy or response? One of the things I heard him say was that Obama could have pressured the other countries not to intervene.
Right.
So let me ask you, how practical do you think it would have been for Obama to pressure Russia not to supply Assad with weapons? And if that is what you are espousing.
It's a good question, Peter. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Reese. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the U.S. obviously has a lot less influence on both Russia and Iran, for that matter, than it does on Saudi Arabia. But I think if the pro-Western powers were not intervening, it undercuts the argument by both Iran and Russia that they therefore are justified in arming Assad. You know, in Tunisia, in Egypt, there were quick overthrows of governments, and outside powers were not a significant factor. I think just because there is an uprising, it doesn't mean the U.S. has to get involved.
But I don't know enough about Syria to know whether what the answer to this question would be. But it seems to me that, you know, Lebanon is different from Libya, is different from Tunisia, is different from Syria.
That's correct.
So you can't have a one-size-fits-all policy, I guess, is what I'm
right.
asking.
No, I agree. And obviously, this I've talked to people in the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government, and it's obviously a very complicated situation. Syria is a horrific tragedy with over 100,000 dead and injured and so on, millions displaced. But we've had civil wars in South Sudan. We've had civil wars in Congo. The Second Congo War had 5.4 million people dead. Most Americans probably have never even heard about those wars because even though they were their consequences were far more horrific, we're hearing about Syria because it's a strategic location. It's in the Middle East. It's next to Israel and Lebanon and Turkey and Iraq and so on. But it is perfectly possible that the people of Syria will resolve this without interference from the U.S. or from other countries.
Are there people that you have talked to in Syria that you feel could take the leadership on this issue?
Yeah, there certainly are. There are generally referred to as civil society activists. There are people who want to see a parliamentary system. There are Islamist forces that I would consider conservative in their social policies, but are willing to have a parliamentary system, are willing to respect the rights of minorities, willing to have a free press and so on. Whoever takes control in Syria, it's not going to be a democracy. It's not going to be some kind of ideal system. But I think the best we could hope for is a system whereby people agree to solve their problems politically, not through arms. And we see that in Tunisia, for example. For all the very real problems there are in Tunisia, by and large, they're solving their problems politically. And I think, yes, there are people that I've met in Syria and certainly leaders in Syria willing to do that.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about Syria in this hour of Radio Times. And again, Reese Ehrlich is our guest. He's a special correspondent for Global Post, lead reporter for their series. It's titled In the Land of Cain and Abel. And he has been to Syria two times since the uprising, and has interviewed government officials, rebels, civilians in Syria and neighboring countries. And again, working on a book about Syria and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, the music of Tchaikovsky, the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra. The January Tchaikovsky Festival begins as Stephen Huff performs the first piano concerto and Robin Tacciotti conducts the Fourth Symphony. Tchaikovsky tickets at 215-893-1999 or online at philorg.org. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, the music of Tchaikovsky with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
On the next Fresh Air, a personal medical and pharmaceutical history of anxiety. We talk with Scott Stossel about his new book, My Age of Anxiety. Stossel has always suffered from many anxieties and phobias and says he wrote the book to help him understand and find relief from or redemption in anxious suffering. Stossel is the editor of The Atlantic Magazine. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Did you ever notice that your memory of an event can change depending on whom you're with? Do you find yourself negotiating the details of a memory with friends or family? On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, we hear from science writer Charles Fernyhough. His book, Pieces of Light, explains how autobiographical memory works. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Reese Ehrlich about the political and humanitarian crisis in Syria. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Reese, there is a peace talk scheduled for January 22nd. And looking like Secretary of State John Kerry, I'm just quoting from the Times today, said on Sunday that Iran might play a role at the peace talks on Syria in Switzerland this month. How do you see Iran and the role it's playing in Syria?
Yeah, I reported from Iran in June of last year, covering elections there, and I followed developments very closely. Iran sees Assad as a key ally in their geopolitical strategy. The Hezbollah in Iran is dependent on getting arms from Iran through Syria. And if Syria falls, if the government in Syria falls, then Iran sees that as a big blow to themselves. On the other hand, they realize that they're not wedded to Assad as such, because he is, after all, a secular dictator, and their alliance with him is a political one, not a religious one. They could live with a Sunni-dominated government in Syria if it was pro-Iranian, so mm-hmm. they kind of hold that open as a backdoor option. At the moment, Iran, I think if you're going to have a political solution in Syria, you've got to include Iran, Russia, the United States, Saudi Arabia, as well as all the parties inside Syria. And so far, while that's kind of an encouraging statement from us, from Secretary of State Kerry, it's not at all clear what role the U.S. would allow Iran to play, or that Iran would be willing to play in a peace conference.
And any of these leaders that you talk to in Syria, any of them going to be at these peace talks that you know of?
Well, that's the other big problem. The Assad government has said it will send representatives. But the rebel groups, the extremist al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, have said they definitely will not participate. And the Free Syrian Army, the what I call the conservative but not extremist rebel groups, have said they would attend, but they've hedged their bets because it's a very unpopular move among within the rebel movement. Mm. So it's not at all clear that this conference is going to take place, or if it does, what will come out of it.
Let me get back to our callers. It looks like we have Mike from Woodstown, New Jersey, joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're
very
welcome.
Appreciate your show.
No problem.
I guess I have a question and a comment. First of all, my question is, why do we always assume that the United States must get involved in every conflict around the world? We've never made a difference anywhere, in my opinion, since World War II. We settled nothing in Korea. We settled nothing in Vietnam, nothing in Iraq, nothing in Afghanistan. Why get involved in another conflict in Syria? And that's my question.
Sure.
My comment also would be, discussing chemical weapons, maybe now we found out where those weapons of mass destruction that President Bush was looking for wound up, crossing the border into Syria.
Well,
possibility there.
Wait, we don't know the answer to that, Mike, but let me take your question and toss it over to you, Reese.
Actually, we do know the answer to that one.
Yeah, exactly.
So, by the way, I agree with Mike completely. Just because there's a crisis in the world doesn't mean the U.S. has to get involved. In fact, there's a strong argument in the case of Syria not to. The Syrian government has actually had chemical weapons for quite a few years. It predates the Iraq War. The Assad government and his father, Hafez al-Assad, had developed chemical weapons as a deterrent against Israel. You recall that Israel and Syria had fought a couple wars, and they thought that if Israel has its nuclear weapons capability, the Syrian government could develop chemical weapons to use as a last-ditch self-defense against an attack from Israel. That was the theory. I don't think it ever made any sense. Chemical weapons are not only horrific and illegal, but they're not a terribly useful weapon in warfare. But that's the origins. It didn't come from Iraq. It was developed intentionally by the Syrian government.
But it also feels, coming from the Obama administration and the president himself, a reluctance to get involved, at least militarily, in some of these conflicts.
No, that's absolutely true. And that is it's a big difference from that time of the first Bush administration. Even by the time of the second Bush administration, they were much more less likely to get involved militarily as well because of the disasters of Iraq and Iran. To be fair, the Obama administration faces some extremely difficult circumstances where not due to any policies of its own, the U.S. has lost the war in Iraq, lost the war in Afghanistan, lost the war in Libya, which actually did take place under Obama, and is widely hated for all kinds of reasons around the Middle East. So the options that the U.S. has for any kind of impact in Syria are limited.
The criticism of the Obama administration is that it makes the United States look weak. Does that resonate with you, Reese?
Yeah, that is indeed the criticism,
right.
But I don't think it makes any sense. Looking back on it, would the United States have been stronger or weaker if we had never gotten involved in Iraq? You know, we had an economic disaster, some 3,000-plus troops killed, the worst economic disaster in U.S. history since the Depression, directly attributable to the wars that were fought. The U.S. would be much stronger by not getting involved.
Mm. You interviewed for Global Post a number of, someone you describe as a close confidant of Assad. As you talk to members of Assad's administration, how do they see this war, this conflict?
Well, they're full of bluster and positive thinking, despite the reality. What they tell foreign reporters and tell their own people is that they're fighting a war against Islamic terrorists. In fact, they've adopted a lot of the rhetoric from the Bush administration and the Obama administration to say they're fighting terrorism. So they claim that from the very beginning, this was not a popular uprising. This was a CIA, Saudi, Israeli plot to overthrow a staunch opponent of Western imperialism, and that from the very beginning there were armed groups from Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia who were involved in the fighting, and it wasn't a popular uprising. Well, that just doesn't correspond with reality. But that's what they tell people, and they say, now look, see what's happening with all these Takfiri groups or impure Muslims is the term, the translation. Look at what all these extremist groups are doing. We told you so.
Hmm. Where does this leave, though, the civilian population in Syria? And it just seems, you know, you read about it, so much suffering, so much misery. And here it is, of course, winter as well, when you just think people living out on the street or in a tent somewhere, it's just they're so exposed to the elements.
No, it is horrible, and particularly those living in the refugee camps. The international community should be doing more to help in all the countries where these folks have been forced to flee. But there's also some of the refugees have been managed to are better off not living in the camps. They've simply gotten apartments or poor housing in the countries where they're now living. They're all expecting to go back, and hopefully they will once there's a political settlement.
And is there support for these Islamist extremists?
There's not a lot of popular support. They have support because they have guns. But particularly there's a group called the ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, that has taken over a number of towns in the north and imposed the harshest kind of Sharia law, has jailed and tortured and shot other rebels that they don't like. And they've created a great deal of animosity, and there's now fighting amongst the rebel groups to get rid of the ISIS. There's been formal declarations by some of the rebel groups to go after them. And, of course, that strengthens the internal fighting, strengthens the hand of the Assad government.
Let me get to it. Looks like Alex from Wilmington, Delaware, to join our conversation. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering, are we going to, in 10 or 15 years, be wringing our hands about not doing enough in Syria the way Bill Clinton did 10 or 15 years after Rwanda. And in that case, it was also a civil war, and there was also a great deal of killing of civilians, and he considers it to be the biggest mistake of his presidency. How do we know that that won't exactly be the same thing that happens with Obama? And, you know, what does it actually mean when we say we're not going to let these things happen again if we keep letting these things happen again in Syria, DRC, South Sudan, regular Sudan, and all those other things? Doesn't it just make it like empty words to make us feel good?
Alex, it's a great question. Reese, I'm sure you've wrestled with this. What do you think?
Sure. Well, the first of all, the situation in Rwanda really was genocide. And it, despite the horrific carnage in Syria, it's not genocide. That's where an entire people, a religious group or an ethnic group, are being murdered by the government in power. So it's not genocide in Syria. But secondly, what is forgotten in the common discussion about Rwanda is that the U.S. and France supported the Hutu government that engaged in the genocide right up to the final months. Then the reason the U.S. didn't intervene was not because there was genocide. It's because they had been backing the wrong side in the struggle, and only very, very late in the game switched sides to condemn the attacks. I would say, you know, I think the listing that Alex made is quite interesting, because in theory there are horrific violence going on in Central African Republic, in South Sudan, in Mali. Should the U.S. be sending troops and occupying all of those countries because of the potential of a genocide? I don't think anybody would make that argument. And I think you have to, you know, at the time when the U.S. could invade and send troops and spend trillions of dollars is over. The U.S. simply cannot make those kind of interventions anymore.
So do we sit on the sidelines or do what we can?
No, I think there's political and there's all kinds of diplomatic and political efforts that can be made short of military action.
Such as?
Well, we talked about before, pressuring other countries not to get involved, pressuring for political settlement. I think the U.S. has a role to play in bringing various groups together, knocking heads, putting pressure on various elements that it can influence inside Syria to reach a political settlement.
Let me see what Richard from Cranberry has to say. Alex, thanks for the call. Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. I'd like your guest to comment on the hypocrisy of the United States in its use of chemical weapons. We are the only country that dropped nuclear and atomic weapons in World War II, and since then we've been using chemical weapons nonstop. We used Agent Orange in Vietnam, killing over 400,000 people and leaving at least a million deformed. We've dropped napalm extensively in Vietnam, and since then we've been using depleted uranium, which has caused massive deformities in Iraq, and white phosphorus, and we supported Saddam Hussein's use of sarin gas in his war with Iran. Surely, if we're going to insist that other countries give up chemical weapons, which are just as despicable as all weapons of war, then the United States should get rid of its stockpile of chemical weapons and assure the world that we're not going to ever use them again.
Richard, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Reese, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. The information he presented is accurate. I would simply add that the U.S. has missed its deadline for destroying its own chemical weapons. The U.S. claims that it needs more time to dismantle its chemical weapons stockpiles. Meanwhile, it can insist that Syria dismantle its chemical weapons on incredibly short notice during wartime conditions. So if the U.S. was serious about destroying its own chemical weapons, it could have done so and should have done so long ago.
You don't think the U.S. is serious about that?
Well, I think they've decided that it's not a priority. It's going to cost a lot of money, and therefore it's been backburnered. I don't think the U.S. Plans to use sarin gas anytime soon, but neither are they serious about destroying it when they could be.
Let me see what looks like Dario from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Dario, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to get a business perspective here. Is there who manufactures most of the weapons, and does the United States have an economic interest here?
We're talking about all the weapons that are being sent to Syria?
Right. Right.
Reese, do you know the answer to that?
Well, so far, the U.S. is arming its rebels with small arms. So it's not like Raytheon or Grumman or any of the big arms manufacturers are making profits at this moment off the war in Syria. In some cases, rebels are being supplied with AK-47s, in other cases with U.S. arms. Some folks are making money. The arms dealers in the Middle East are making the money off this mm-hmm. deal. But that's not a... if you want to look at economics, Syria has a small amount of oil. It's not a major factor, but it is important for the future government of Syria. Syria's geopolitical location is the key reason why so many people are fighting over it, because mm-hmm. of its location next to Israel, Iraq, Turkey, and so on.
Daria, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Reese, we're almost out of time here, but what are the kind of precautions you have to take to report from Syria?
Well, timing is a lot. I was in Lebanon several times this year, and now suddenly there's bombs going off in areas that have been considered safe before. So I look very carefully at the timing of the situation. I take precautions on transport, and I take advice from local reporters and people that I work with and get their advice, because day to day, for example, I was going to go from Damascus to Homs. It was a relatively short ride. The government assured me that it was safe, and then 2 days later, it wasn't safe anymore. So I took their word for it and didn't make that trip. It would have been very dangerous. So I try to use common sense and listen carefully to the local folks.
Well, stay safe, and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again when my book comes out.
Indeed. And again, Reese Ehrlich, special correspondent for Global Post, lead reporter for their series, the series titled In the Land of Cain and Abel. And yes, he is working on a book about Syria to be published in about a year or so. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, go to our homepage and you can leave a comment. You can carry on a conversation that we started on the air today. You can also check us out on Facebook, Twitter, archives, podcasts, satellite radio, and send us an email. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.